Breakfast at Sally's, written by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 14. Angel of Prey. Prey is spelled P-R-E-Y, not P-R-A-Y. I headed back toward the lights of town and found a gas station. I put $9 worth of gas in the tank and saved $1 to buy Willow dinner. She was hungry, so I went to the McDonald's drive-thru and got her a hamburger. That was one of her favorite treats, when we could afford it. We lucked out because it was a 2-for-1 burger night, so we both had dinner on that $1. I pulled out Tina's instructions again and headed out in that direction. It began to rain as we navigated the turns on Ohio, Indiana, California, and finally John Road, past the dead-end sign around the curve. The road turned to gravel with huge potholes, so I searched for the first trailer on the right. About a mile down the rutted road, I was greeted by headlights coming directly at me in the middle of the road. So I slowed and pulled over, flicking my lights. A pickup truck pulled up alongside me. It had a big blue top covering the back. The window rolled down and a man stuck out his head. I put my window down and heard the loud roar of an engine in desperate need of a new muffler. Exhaust fumes filled the air and assaulted my nostrils. "Lost?" the man yelled over the roar. "Yeah," I said reluctantly, sticking my head out. "I'm looking for Tina. I don't know her last name." "That's okay," he said. "I know who you mean. I just left there. Just keep on going. And good luck," he smiled. I rolled the window back up and took a deep breath. I was tired. "We're almost there, girl," I told Willow. We drove on, around a curve and down a small hill. Then I spotted Tina's trailer. I pulled into the driveway, and the headlights of the van revealed a small camper just behind the big trailer. I knew that had to be our new home. I dashed through the rain up to the door and knocked. "Just a minute," yelled a voice from inside. About 30 seconds later, the door opened. "Here you are," said Tina, abruptly handing me a broom and dustpan. "I haven't had a chance to clean it up for you. You might need these. The door is open. I'm off tomorrow, so I'll see you then," she added, closing the door. I picked up the equipment and headed back to get Willow out of the van. I grabbed her in my arms and juggled her and the broom and dustpans until I got to the camper door and used my little finger to pull the latch. Thankfully, the door swung open easily, and we quickly climbed inside to get out of the now pouring rain. I closed the door and set Willow down, while digging in my pockets for a book of matches. The lit match provided just enough light for me to locate the switch. I flipped it and saw Willow was sitting at my feet. I bent down to scratch her head. "Willow, girl, we have a home, and the lady said we can stay a while." She responded to the excitement in my voice with a squeal and a good shake. It was thrilling to know that we weren't going to have to pack up and leave in the morning. Whenever I awoke after a one-night stay in a motel or on somebody's couch, I always had a sinking feeling, knowing we would be sleeping in the van again by nightfall. I looked around the small camper. There were some dirty dishes in the sink and an unmade bed in the back, but it was quite comfortable considering how the rain was pounding on the metal roof. The wind picked up as I opened the door to go get my sleeping bag from the van. A gust caught the door and slammed it into the side of the camper. I took a deep breath and stepped out into the storm, holding my cap in place with one hand and pulling the door closed with the other. Then I raced to the van to get what I needed. It didn't take long, but I was dripping wet by the time I climbed back into the trailer. So I took off my soaked shirt and laid it by the sink. Then I stripped the sheets off the bed, discovering a Tootsie Roll candy wrapper, some popcorn kernels, and some mouse leavings. I rolled up the sheets, sweeping the debris onto the floor, and rolled out my sleeping bag. It had been a long day, being saved and all, and I was cold and tired. I finished taking off my wet clothes, called Willow, and we eased into the sleeping bag. This blur of a day began to sort itself out as my muscles began to relax. This was too good to be true. Somebody had given me a place to stay with no strings attached. What a nice thing to do, I thought. I need the rest. I'm going to sleep till noon. Willow had already found her way to the bottom of the sleeping bag and was warming my feet. It was quiet, except for the pounding rain. It reminded me of my first childhood home back in Ohio. My parents' home had a green metal roof, and I loved to fall asleep to the sound of the rain. I rolled on my side, and within seconds, I was asleep. Dawn had just broken when I heard the pounding on the aluminum door. "Richard, it's me," Tina's voice called out. I heard the door open and then footsteps as she stomped into the camper. I opened one blurry eye to see Tina's face hovering over me. "I've been called into work today," she said. "I was talking to my husband last night, and we were thinking it might be best if you paid us something for letting you stay here," she added. I began to answer as I regained my senses. "Maybe 200 or 300 a month," she suggested. "Well, right now I was having trouble responding.
"You don't have to pay today," she said. "In a day or two would be fine. I've got to get going to work."
She turned and headed for the door. The commotion awakened Willow from her slumber, and she made her way out from under the covers, placing her head beside mine. Neither of us was quite awake yet, but that didn't stop the worrying. Where was I going to get a couple of $100 in 2 days? I heard Tina's car start, back up, and then churn up a little gravel as she sped away. I knew I wasn't going to be able to fall back into slumber, so I began preparing myself to get up and face the day. So much for sleeping till noon. I slowly pushed myself out of bed and slipped on my jeans, my shirt, and my still wet socks and shoes, and I opened the door of the camper. I was facing the back door of Tina's trailer. Two women were standing on a small wooden porch by the door, both puffing away on cigarettes. They smiled at me as I rubbed the sleep from my eyes and stepped out of the camper.
"You must be the new boy," said one.
They were skinny women, almost frail, I thought, as I approached. Both wore jeans and old sweatshirts, and neither was wearing shoes.
"Homeless guy, right?"
the frailer of the two asked in a voice affected by some type of speech impediment. I nodded.
"It didn't take her long to replace Roy,"
the other lady said, and they both chuckled.
"You must have passed Roy on your way in," she said. "He lived in the camper for a couple of months."
"Did he have an old truck that needed a new muffler?" I asked.
"Yes,"
she answered.
"He stopped me to give me directions last night," I said. "My name is Richard."
I extended my hand.
"I'm Madonna," the woman said, extending her hand in return. "This is Roberta."
I shook hands with the other woman as well.
"You want a cup of coffee?"
Roberta asked. She took a big drag on her cigarette, tilted her head up, and slowly blew the smoke into the air.
"Sure," I answered. "I'd love one."
Roberta snuffed out her cigarette on the wet railing on the porch and then opened the trailer door and went inside.
"You've been living in your car?"
Madonna asked.
"Yeah, for a while," I answered. I sort of lost track of time. "Tina said you could stay here?" she asked. "For free?"
"Yes," I replied, and then hesitated. "Yesterday she said I could stay for free, but this morning she said she and her husband had talked it over and they thought I should pay something." Madonna smiled, and then she turned her head away. Roberta came through the trailer door with a cup of coffee in her hand.
"Here's your coffee," she said, holding it out to me.
"Thank you," I said, taking it in both hands.
"Tina said he could stay here for free yesterday and then told him today he needed to pay something,"
Madonna informed her, laughing.
"That's the last thing you're going to get here for free," said Roberta, pointing to my coffee. "Oh, look, Roberta," Madonna said, looking toward the camper. "A puppy.
Willow had decided to face the world herself and was standing at the door of the camper, looking out. "That's my friend Willow. Come, girl," I called, and she jumped out into the wet grass and scurried to the porch.
"She's darling,"
Roberta said, bending to pet her. Willow stretched as Roberta rubbed her back. Madonna also bent down to pet Willow on the head. While the women were cooing over Willow, my eyes panned out to survey the neighborhood. It appeared that I was at the end of a dead-end road. There was another blue trailer about 50 yards away, covered by a moldy plastic carport held up by 2x4s. A 1970s Chevy Monte Carlo was sitting on blocks in the front yard, its hood missing, and the back right side undergoing an extensive Bondo treatment. Two rusted burn barrels sat beside the driveway. These women both appeared to be nearing 40 or had just breached that magical age for women. Roberta was the shorter of the two. She had long, stringy black hair that needed brushing. Her chin jutted out from her lean face, and her eyes were deep set. Madonna had her strawberry blonde hair cut short, and it was obvious to me that it was not professionally done, even by the gals down at Supercuts. She either cut it herself or Roberta did it. The sleeves of her pale green sweatshirt had been cut off, revealing the bottom half of a red and blue heart-shaped tattoo with the words Dale and Madonna forever etched into her skin. I took Willow to a park in town for a romp and spent much of the day looking for some type of work. At each job search stop, someone would hand me an application, I would fill it out, and then they would tell me, "Somebody will call you." Since I had no telephone number, I knew that was going to be hard to do. I found the St. Vincent de Paul Assistance Center in town and asked if they could help me out. They gave me a $10 cash voucher for the nearby 76th station, $5 in cash, and a list of the churches that provided free meals to the poor. I already knew that list by heart. Fortunately, the Lutheran church was serving an outstanding tuna noodle casserole that evening at 6. I reluctantly made my way back to Tina's about 7, not knowing what to expect. Would Tina be Jekyll or Hyde? But luck was on my side, at least for the moment. Willow and I made it uneventfully back to our new residence and into bed without any contact with our new benefactress/landlady. The sound of Tina yelling at the top of her lungs woke me from my slumber.
"You can't do anything right, you stupid bitch! You don't do anything I tell you! I ought to kick your ass out onto the street where you came from!"
I could hear a woman sobbing, and I thought I could hear her saying,
I try, through the sobs. "Don't throw me out. I have no place to go."
The voices stilled for a moment. I rolled over on my side and closed my eyes. But it wasn't over.
"What did you say?"
Tina demanded in a loud voice.
I, stammered Roberta in response. "You shouldn't get so mad at me." "Mad?"
Tina shrieked.
"I'll show you mad. Get in your room."
I could hear the stomping of feet and a door slamming. Slowly, I sat up in bed and moved the curtain aside to look out. In the porch light, Madonna was lighting a cigarette. She took a big drag, tilted her head up, and exhaled. Then she leaned against the side of the trailer and sighed a deep sigh. Eventually, she stood up and stepped off the porch, cocking her head slightly to the left as she began to walk. She looked up, took about 15 paces, and then stopped. Then she cocked her head a few degrees more, and as she walked back into the light, I could see the pain and concern in her expression. I let the curtain fall back down into place and lay back down. I sighed to myself. There was nothing I could do. The yelling continued, but now at least it was muffled by the closed door of Roberta's room. I had been awake for about half an hour, lying in bed, with my hands held behind my head, listening to the birds chirping in the early morning light. I had my escape plan in place and was waiting for Tina to leave for work. I had locked the camper door.
The peaceful sounds of the birds stopped abruptly as the trailer door opened and then slammed shut. Then I heard the sound of the latch on the camper door being pulled.
"Crap," Tina muttered.
There was a rustling of keys, and a second or two later she opened the door and stepped in. "Richard, don't forget that money today," she said as she stepped toward the door and stood over me.
"Okay," I said.
Then she turned and stormed out the door, slamming it closed. She got into her car, the engine turned over, the transmission screeched into reverse, and gravel flew as she accelerated. I took a few deep breaths and listened for the birds to begin singing again. A few seconds later, right on schedule, I heard Roberta and Madonna open the door for their morning smoke. I could hear their voices. Roberta was crying, and Madonna was trying to console her. I got out of bed, put on my clothes, and wrote a quick note to Tina. "Sorry I have to leave, but I have no money and no prospects for any. Thank you, Richard." I put it on the fold-out table in the kitchen. I pulled open the curtain and peeked outside. The two women were still standing at the back door in their bare feet, puffing away. Madonna looked my way, and I knew she had seen the motion of the curtain and sensed my prying eyes. I closed the curtain and stepped back. I decided I'd better find out what was going on, so I opened the door and stepped out. "Good morning."
"Good morning," Madonna replied.
Roberta was quiet, and she looked toward the ground. Then she looked up at my face and took another drag off her cigarette. Her face was strained, and it was easy to see she had been crying. "What kind of cigarettes do you smoke?" I asked, trying to engage in some small talk.
"Salem Lights,"
she said, pulling the pack from the pocket of her jeans and showing me the nearly empty green and white package. "Tina seemed to be in a rush this morning," I observed. The ladies just nodded and puffed.
"You want a cigarette?" Madonna asked.
"Yeah. I don't smoke very often, but every once in a while I do. Thanks." She reached in her pocket, pulled out the pack, and pulled out one for me.
"Here you go,"
she said. I took it. She reached for the lighter. I leaned forward and got a light. A few seconds of silence passed, and then Madonna filled the void.
"I suppose you heard the screaming last night?"
"Yeah, I did," I said. "Is everything okay?"
"Oh, it's something you're going to have to get used to if you plan to stay," she said. "But she doesn't have the right to hit me," Roberta blurted out. "She should be put in jail. She treats me bad. I hate her."
"Jesus, Roberta, slow down," Madonna interrupted. "You know nobody can understand you when you talk so fast. Slow down." I could see the tears welling up in Roberta's eyes as she looked at her friend.
"It wasn't that big a deal," Roberta said. "So what if I forgot to put a coaster under my glass on the coffee table? It didn't hurt it."
She stared at the ground dejectedly.
"Now I'm not allowed to have any pop for 2 weeks."
"You know that isn't why she got on you, Roberta," Madonna said. "She must have had a bad day at work, or maybe she lost a lot of money at the casino on her way home. She was pissed off at something else, and she took it out on you." She paused and looked toward me. "Tina takes everything out on Roberta. When something goes wrong, she starts in on her."
"What a shame," I said. "But you don't have to take it," I suggested.
"Oh, you don't really want to mess with Tina," Madonna said. "She will rip you a new one, little man. Her husband is scared to death of her. He drives a truck, and I can tell you he is only happy when he is on the road."
I laughed, but then quickly began wondering what I had gotten myself into. Roberta was angry.
"She's so mean to me. She yells at me and hits me and takes my shoes and locks them up so I can't leave. It ain't right," she added, brushing a tear from her cheek.
I looked at them in disbelief.
"Yeah, she does," Madonna began. "She locks up our shoes when she's gone, so we can't just walk off." "She takes all our money, too," Roberta interrupted, nodding her head. "That ain't right, neither."
I stared at them again, bewildered.
Yeah, Madonna said. We both get money from the state. Roberta isn't quite right. Can't you see that? And, well, I've got my problems, too. We both get $336 a month plus $150 in food money on our food cards. When our money comes in, Tina takes it for rent. She buys all the food on our cards. We make dinner, clean the house, and take care of the place. We have to keep track of everything we use. She even charges us to do our laundry. $1.50 to wash and $1 to dry and $1 for a scoop of soap. She buys our cigarettes out of the money and gives us $30 in cash each month. We can't go nowhere, Roberta said. We can't afford our own place. No one will give us a job. We've been here for 2 years now. Roy was paying $200 a month to live in the camper, Madonna said. He was cutting firewood and selling it by the cord, but then his truck broke down a couple of times and he had to buy parts. He couldn't pay, so she kicked him out.
Why don't you ladies get an apartment together somewhere else? In my astonishment, I was grasping for helpful suggestions. I had sensed the unhealthiness of this place, but I had no idea it was this bad. Madonna chuckled.
The cheapest place we'd be able to find would be $450 to $500 a month, plus another $50 a month for electric. They're going to want first and last and a damage deposit. Plus, Roberta got herself caught shoplifting twice, she continued, raising her voice and lifting her eyebrows. And my ex beat me up so bad that I spent several days in the hospital and he went to jail. He's been out for a while now, but I know that if he ever finds me, he's going to kill me. I'm counting on him not being able to find me here. This is the best place we've got right now,
she said emphatically, nodding at the trailer. I considered Madonna's plight. She was poor, hiding out in her own prison, wearing the brand of a person who would kill her when he got out of jail. As for Roberta, she wasn't making any move to get her things packed, so I assumed Tina had not actually thrown her out, in spite of the threats. It was time for me to share my plans with them. I stepped closer. I'm taking off this morning, I said. I want you to know it was a pleasure for me to meet you.
Oh, Tina's not going to like this, Madonna said.
She took a long drag off her cigarette and shook her head for emphasis. I'm heading for Bremerton, I said. I was thinking, well, I could give you girls a ride into town, and maybe you could get some shoes and some help finding a place, and, well, I was thinking maybe you girls could get a fresh start. A glimmer of hope appeared in Roberta's eyes. But Madonna had begun to stiffen as soon as I suggested the ride. There was no hope in her eyes. It's a risk, I continued, but sometimes you have to.
Maybe we could, Madonna.
Roberta was actually getting excited.
Maybe we could.
But this time her voice trailed off as she saw Madonna's expression. As the two became quiet, I realized the answer was no. Madonna snuffed out her cigarette.
Come on, Roberta. I'll brush your hair.
She opened the door. Roberta put her cigarette out, and they both disappeared inside. The closing of that trailer door could not have been more final if it had been a jail cell door slamming shut. These two women were serving a life sentence, parole denied, and worse yet, hope gone. And that was the ultimate devastation of hopelessness, whether or not the victims had a roof over their heads. With a heavy heart, I turned back to the camper. It didn't take more than a few minutes to gather my clothes, get Willow, and head for the van. I turned the key, shifted into reverse, and slowly backed up. I then put the van in drive and quietly pulled away, trying not to disturb the gravel as we made our escape. Breakfast at Sally's, Chapter 15, David's Song. I was heading back to Bremerton, knowing I would be sleeping in the back of the van again. I'd had a home for a couple of days, but now I was free. In many ways, I thought, the homeless are the freest of all. We have no dignity, no honor, no pride, no ego to protect. We are like Hare Krishnas, living in the assurance that Mother Earth, the universe, or the grace of God will somehow provide. I was anxious to get back to Sally's for some breakfast and to see C. I couldn't wait to show him my freshly blessed bush bumper sticker, to share with him how I had been saved, and to tell him about my escape from Tina's compound. It was about 7:30 in the morning when I drove down 6th Street toward Sally's. Workers were using a mobile crane to place patriotic decorations on the light poles for the city's Memorial Day parade. Three motorcycle cops had parked their rigs in front of the downtown theater and were rousting two of the Vietnam vets I had seen at Sally's many times, Ogre and Hillbilly, from their sleeping quarters under the marquee. Ogre was struggling to roll up his sleeping bag with his one good arm and the stub that remained of his left one, and Hillbilly, his matted hair sticking out from under his soiled baseball cap, was picking up a couple of empty beer bottles and some trash and putting them in his backpack under the watchful eyes of police officers who stood waiting with their hands on their hips. I kept rolling on by. The line to get into Sally's had grown longer while I was away at Tina's. The door didn't swing open until 8, but by 7:45 the line went around the corner of the building. I saw a Chinese couple for the first time. That was unusual. The man, maybe 60 years old, was slumped at the shoulders and avoided eye contact. The woman stood quietly with those worried eyes I knew so well. They didn't want to be seen in this line. They still had some pride left. I wished C was there. He would have known what to say to make them more comfortable. As I waited in line, I kept looking out for him. Who or what was C? I had wondered about that from time to time when I could not find him. Was he some imaginary friend I had created the way a child would? I knew that wasn't true, because I could smell him when he was around. I was repulsed by his dumpster diving. He would fish a half-eaten Big Mac and fries from a trash can and eat them like a hungry stray dog. He could not pass up a trash can. He often looked like Pigpen from Peanuts, dust flying from his stained clothes. He wasn't afraid to get down and dirty with the beggars and the drunks, cleaning up their puke, duct-taping the soles to the tops of their shoes. C had energy. He was like a 5-year-old just before bedtime, never wanting to go to sleep, always afraid he might miss something. And he was a man of God, though maybe not in what many would consider the traditional sense. If anyone in the history of man was going to move a mountain with faith, it would be C. He talked to the crows, and they would often gather in his presence. He was like a box of Whitman chocolates, 1 minute a cherry cordial, then a tart orange, then a nut. I wanted to toss away pieces of him I didn't like, but found it impossible. I came to admire him. He would quote Yeats while sitting on a park bench eating peanut butter from a jar with his fingers. Of all the people I had ever met, lawyers, judges, priests, bankers, star athletes, C was the most alive, the most attuned. Women were attracted to his blue eyes and the dulcet tones of his voice, but he would challenge their intellects and their spirituality in a mental sparring contest I didn't quite understand. They wanted to talk about Oprah or Dr. Phil or the next American Idol. He wanted to talk about Carlos Castaneda or John Paul Sartre. He seemed to want to get into their brains, not their pants. C was a long hair, in an age when short hair was in, and he didn't like to have his picture taken. He would turn his face away or get up and move out of range whenever a camera was pointed anywhere in his direction. That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on The Bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The Bookshelf is produced and edited by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.